One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One
Aslan
ring to rule them all.
A lion.
One
the
ring
lion.
To find them.
The great lion.
The Aslan wheel of time turns and ages come
the
and pass.
Lion.
The wheel of time
of
turns and ages come and pass.
The
wheel of time
itself.
Turns and ages come and pass.
Books from Earth, a podcast. Relive your favorite books of fantasy, sci-fi, and apocalyptic stories. Yes, there are lots of spoilers. The spoiling is constant. Yes, there can be adult content. We are adults making content. Spoilers, adult content. Books from Earth, time to relive a favorite book.
Welcome to the Books from Earth podcast, featuring Peter Hamilton's Pandora's Star, a mind-blowing, galactic-bending, spy thriller, noir mystery, space opera, fantasy, science fiction, kitchen sink extravaganza, world-building at comet speed, a villain like no other, or maybe two villains like no other. Anyway, today we relive this huge novel space opera, book one of two, really. With Books from Earth. I'm Josh, and I'm joined by my fellow Books from Earth podcasters, Lou.
Hey, guys.
Maureen.
Hello.
And Jack.
Greetings.
First, let's go back and revisit what this book is about.
So this book is, the plot lines are like a bowl of spaghetti. They go everywhere. It is like 600 pages of world building. So if you're not into that, this isn't the book for you. But if you love kick-ass world building, you'll love this book. The main, the opening of the book starts with in present day, or maybe 30, 40, 50 years from present day, with an astronaut mission to Mars, first manned spaceflight to Mars. The ship is piloted by Admiral Keim, and they come in for a landing, which he executes perfectly, turns off the computer and brings it in manually. And they're about to step out onto the red planet when all of a sudden they see some like young like surfer dude in like a old fashioned scuba outfit. Because while intra-solar system travel was just taking off, two young hippie type guys had developed wormhole travel, and they beat all the nations of the world to Mars, these two geniuses. And that's where it begins, with the massive disappointment of Admiral Keim, the culmination of his life's work being upstaged in front of the world. The next chapter is 230 years into the future, where wormhole technology is completely taken over, and spaceships are a thing of the past. So in this book, spaceships are not a thing until they become a thing, which I'll get to in a second. But the worlds, several hundred habitable human-friendly worlds, are connected by a series of wormholes. The wormholes carry trains to take people from one world to the next. You could commute to work on a planet that's 200 light years from your home. The worlds are also connected by the wormhole technology, and each planet has a planet sphere, much like, think, Wi-Fi for a whole planet. And those Wi-Fi planet spheres are connected to the Unisphere, which draws everyone together. A bumbling astronomer, Dudley Bowes, we don't know this at the time, but he's kind of tipped off to, you know, point your telescope at these two suns really far away. And he does, you know, and he finds that they completely disappear. They're enveloped by something, and he catches the whole thing on, he watches these two suns blink out of existence. Estimated to be about 2,500 light years away. Humanity, in its never-ending desire and driven by curiosity, has to find out why. Was it a threatening society within these two suns, or was this a defensive act against a threatening race outside, you know, that was threatening them. So they enter the rocket, the using wormhole technology, humankind pulls together in a Manhattan Project like way to build an awesome wormhole technology spaceship. The drivers behind this are important characters. Nigel Sheldon, the guy, the surfer dude who showed up in the old school scuba diving outfit on Mars. He is the inventor of wormhole technology. He is a billionaire beyond anything we've ever seen before. And he's behind this. Wilson Keim is tapped to pilot it. And it is the story of mankind going to these two, well, to one of these spheres. And lo and behold, they cause the sphere to open and they unleash a highly, highly, highly hostile enemy, Morning Light Mountain. And we'll get more into him later. There are sub-threads throughout the story, and the three main ones are the story of the SI and the SI's agent. The SI is the sentient intelligence, which is artificial intelligence that has divorced itself from mankind. Yet they use agents among mankind to gather intelligence, one of those agents being a socialite / failed Olympian / really attractive reporter. And she, her journey is pretty deep, and we'll get into it. Melanie Rescore. Her story is finding out about the prime threat, and the primes, the Morning Light Mountain is a prime. That's one subplot, but a very important one. The second one is Nigel Sheldon's partner. Travels the Sylphin paths. There are other sentient beings that Earth, that the humans have come across. Two main ones, Rael and Sylphin, and they are friendly but not particularly helpful. Kind of like a cousin you never see and wouldn't recognize. And the Sylphin paths seem to have some sort of a similarity to wormholes, where you go traveling from planet to planet. Technology does not work on the Sylphin paths. Third thread is a guy named Mark, who is a engineer who works, who lives with his family on a very beautiful planet, and then eventually works full time on the rocket rocket spaceship. And his story is really kick ass too. So there's a fourth story hanging over back behind everything, and that story is the story of the Starflyer, which you learn a lot more about in the second book. But in the first book, if the Starflyer is a real thing, it is said that the Starflyer is manipulating the human society, and there's, you know, one druid type character screaming in the night, trying to get society to wake up. And he uses terroristic like activities and to wake humanity up, and it's not working. And he believes, and his name, and we'll get to him, is Bradley Johansson. He believes that the Starflyer is manipulating humankind to go to the Dyson spheres. Sons that Dudley Bose, the absent-minded professor, uncovered. So that's the least detailed version of the plot that I could possibly give, because it goes everywhere. And there's many stories within that, and it's a great, great, super fun book.
Oh, that was an incredible synopsis. It is this book was just a spider web of different interconnecting stories and characters and world building so fast, and that really brought it together. And I wanted to jump into something that was so interesting about this book that I had not come across really in any other science fiction book yet that I've read. I'm sure it's out there, but that is the way the technology developed in human society so that folks could be immortal, mm-hmm. basically. There's this technology called rejuvenation. Humans are implanted with some kind of crystal, and it can basically absorb their every thought, action, everything, consciousness, etc. And it can be downloaded to the sphere, and so at any time somebody passes away, they can just clone them and download back from the crystal into them their personality, their memories, and you know, if they want, they can have some memories changed. So they can start more fresh if they want, or not. And they can be born into a body that, you know, looks like them or doesn't. They can kind of do alterations and so forth. And so we have this world where folks are not afraid to die.
But we also have a world where murder, true murder, is almost – it's a unicorn. It's totally rare, where you would have your full body death plus the death of your memories, which, like rebooting a computer, if you haven't saved your Word doc and your computer dies, you might have lost your whole Word doc or half a day's work or 2 hours worth of your research paper. Same thing can happen with memories. Very wild.
Right. So folks could be missing days or weeks, and that's a key detail to some of the investigations that Paula Mayo is doing as she's trying to hunt down Bradley Johansen and his, you know, group of terrorists. What it made society look like, you know, a society where most people are relatively younger than average. It seems like everybody in the book is beautiful, and there's this sense of play. Like, let's just kind of play and have fun. And yes, there are people who are richer than others, but I didn't get this huge sense of disparity. I mean, at least, you know, most people could afford this basic technology of to live forever. And I was just kind of blown away by the concept. It affected the story in just ways that I just feel like I haven't seen in a while.
Well, I'm right there with you. And one of the things that kind of blew my mind was that it was very much the Star Trek version of Utopia, where, you know, you have everybody that is in the Earth and all of its outreaches get along with each other. You know, you've got the United Federation of whatever it is. And then the threat comes from the outside. But the thing that really kind of sparked my imagination in this book was that, like piggybacking on what Jack was saying, not only is there not like murder, there's also not really punishment, because as a society, what we say when you disobey the law is we are going to take away some of your time, you know? So, and we don't really take away people's freedom. We take away their time. And when you have infinite time, there really isn't any form of, like, because we had the big murder investigation, and all that really happened to the guy was that he lost 160 years, but he had already lived for centuries.
Morton?
You know?
Morton.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that was the thing that kind of like sparked my imagination, is like, what would you do when you have infinite resources in yourself? And so I guess people in the universe are kind of good for the sake of being good, which is awesome. You know, it's that idea that everybody's needs are being met, so they don't have a need to go and do crime. What happens, you know, when somebody does do crime, and how is that addressed? So that's what I was thinking.
That's good. And also, what matters to some of these people is the accumulation of power, the accumulation of riches, beauty, sex. Very few characters are interested in developing a spiritual life or developing having experience for the sake of experience, other than to say they did it, let's say, or to get a thrill, because they live almost in a consequence-free world. Of course, that's about to change.
Yeah, they got me thinking that this world has one of the most amazing, like the Star Trek utopian world is one of the most amazing features in that they've solved the death problem. You mm-hmm. know, it's like it's so utopian that they've even solved the death problem. And so our villain has to be like, in, you know, a counterbalance to that and has to be like the ultimate destruction of possible. And so the villain, or at least I think the villain, one of the villains,
Morning
Light Mountain.
Morning Light Mountain.
I write the whole book. Every time I saw it, it's kind of what I was reading. I just blurred over it. Morning Light
MLM.
Mountain. Morning Light Mountain, which sounds like something out of North Korea. And it's like, you know, this just ultimate something, overpowering thing of destruction. I like how this perfect world that's even conquered death is now up against something that could destroy it. And it's quite amazing.
But is Morning Light Mountain a power of destruction, or is it a power of consumption?
Whoa.
Deep. Morning Light Mountain is a virus. This is not coming from, like, the book or the second book. This is my view. Morning Light. So real quick, Morning Light Mountain is one of the primes. He's an immotile. So big brain, can't move. He's connected electronically to subsentient beings called motiles, and he can control them. And he's one of several, maybe many primes in his solar system. They expand, eventually live on their entire solar system and compete with each other, these primes. Some primes get the idea to go to another solar system. So they do that. And they, when a prime takes over, they are obsessed with purity. And when they take over an area, they can't help but take on some of the traits like a virus would, right? Like a virus mutates, so do the primes. And the beta primes, the ones that went to the other sphere, they allowed themselves to be corrupted. I'm looking at this through the point of view of Morning Light Mountain. They allowed themselves to be corrupted, so which is just the worst, right? I mean, Morning Light Mountain is beyond racist. He is beyond speciesist. He believes that, or she believes that it should be the only sentient being in the universe. And it, to me, is more like a virus in that sense. What I thought, I don't know, Josh, did you want to do Morning Light Mountain now, or do you want to stay on your theme?
Let's roll more. It's fascinating.
So Morning Light Mountain, to me, the Peter Hamilton did a great job having the reader look through a lens that's really not human. The Morning Light Mountain couldn't understand that humans that are somewhat like motiles in his point of view, things, you know, that there's not a central intelligence governing them like he did with his motiles. And I thought that was really cool and interesting, but he is threatened by any other sentient being and thinks that they should be he should be the only one, essentially. But I thought he was just a horrifyingly scary, excellent villain.
Yeah, and you know, Maureen highlighted the chapter in the book, chapter 18, where the author just introduces us to this monstrosity.
It was my favorite. It was such a, like, I'm 100% on board with you, Jack. And I'll read, like, a little bit from chapter 18 because it is – I don't have a favorite passage. I have a favorite chapter. But it just – the introduction to something that was so alien a concept and being able to understand from its point of view. Oh, wow. What a payoff. Because is like as much world building as we did for the first, you know, 17 chapters of the book, I don't think the payoff would have been as good if we had missed any of it. You know, we get this construction of a society that is utopian in nature. Everybody's rich, everybody's pretty, and everybody lives forever. you know, all of their instincts are satisfied. And then, and it seems like a world where people could really, where it's like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And then we get this creature that I have nothing in common with, but can completely understand. It was beautifully written. May I read a little bit from my favorite
chapter? Go for it.
Chapter?
Yep, go for it.
All right, chapter 18. No prime emotile had a name. Names were derived from a communication system completely different from their species' direct nerve impulse linkages. They did, of course, have ways of identifying each other. Emotiles, even in their group cluster form, were above all individual, a factor that sprang out of their early history's territorialism. Alliances between them were built and fractured with reliable regularity in their planet's pre-mechanization age. When even the closest partnerships were liable to be swiftly discarded if an advantage could be pursued with another. Disputes in those days were always over the size of territory and the available resources, mainly fresh water and farmland. Little changed over the millennia. After mechanization flourished, the nature of the alliances altered as the demands of machinery had to be met. Although the maneuvering and ever-flowing tides of allegiance continued to be played by the same rules of deception and force, there was one emotile that has always managed to retain its preeminence among the rest of its species, always building the strongest alliances, always advancing itself at the expense of others, always holding its boundaries secure, always the most wily, in later times the largest and most powerful of all, although not named. It could be characterized by its location, Morning Light Mountain, a large cone of rock and earth that sprouted at the center of a long valley defined by rugged cliffs rising hundreds of meters from its swampy floor. Such was the alignment of the height walls that the thick beams of sunlight that the irregular edges produced swept across the central peak only during the morning. And I'm going to stop there because I will read the whole damn thing.
Morning Light Mountain could be the embodiment of what would happen if human technology just like kind of kept going. You know, we have this creature is like the ultimate AI. It just doesn't seem to have any human compassion, connection, or anything. It just consumes resources to become bigger, better, stronger, and keeps on growing. It reminds me of like the Terminator, you know,
the Borg.
The Borg, mm-hmm. The Terminator. Another theme in this book was sort of what's better, you know, nature or what mankind does. I remember there's a particular scene in the book where one of the socialites reconnects with a fling that she had with one of the rebels. They make love without, and she notes, without any enhancements or any of the drugs that most people took in that time. And her kind of ending statement was just how awesome it was to experience something real and unenhanced. Here we have humankind that they're not getting the real experience, and the real experience is better than all their tricks, all their tech, everything they've been able to put on. And here's Morning Light Mountain is what I guess his vision is, like the ultimate worst trajectory of human technology taking us there.
You know, it never struck me when I was reading it, but when Maureen was reading it, it reminded me of city-states and then eventually countries. And
like Great Britain.
Yeah, Great Britain ending in World War I, you know, watching everything collapse and then rebuilding and all that stuff, yeah.
And colonialism. I kind of tie the whole primes to British imperialism. And where they're off and they're like, this is mine and that's mine and that's mine and you can stay here, but you're one of us now. And Lou, you have not said a word. Do you want to chime in on anything?
Well, I have to say this is definitely one of my favorite books we've read so far. For me, the Morning Light Mountain was kind of like the Cylons. Not quite like them, but they're thinking. They just want to just gather everything up, you know, just take over, in this case, the human race, you know. I don't think the primes really care about that. They just want to take over everything. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, even his own people, he just took over.
He's also, I keep saying he, it.
It's not, I know, it's,
yeah, it is super intelligent.
Very.
Way intelligent. More intelligent than even the SI, the sentient intelligence, you know, the artificial intelligence that left. More intelligent than Ozzy and Nigel. But so limited.
Ozzy's my man. Don't insult my Ozzy.
I love Ozzy.
Ozzy's my favorite too.
One of the other races, I guess the primes are one of the races out there in the universe that I hope you can shed some light on, because I don't know what is going on with the Sylphin.
The Sylphin?
What is up with the Sylphin?
The Sylphin to me are like big fairies, large fairies. You know, fairies are like little miniature, but they're a little bit bigger. So they're these little creatures, they're childlike, and they have these paths. And we're introduced to them with Ozzy and the young guy, you know, his 15-year-old friend. And they get on these paths, but they hold some kind of key.
The Sylphin paths are kind of like the wormhole technology, but magic maybe. And instead of the wormhole technology, which is in a split second, you've gone, you know, 300 light years. This is gradual. So you're walking a forest path, and then it starts to get a little colder, a little colder, a little colder. And it's happening gradually, you know, like a frog in the warming water. And then next thing you know, you're in like a tundra, a frozen tundra.
Right? In another world.
In another world. Exactly. And Ozzy and his compatriots, including Tochi, which was an excellent character, find themselves going from world to world. They go to a frozen world. They go to a ghost world where there's no life left and they can see ghosts. They go to a world that's, you know, mostly water. They go to these various worlds. Ozzy is on this search for who the Dysons are, right? This, he doesn't know about the primes. He's gone for like 3 or 4 years on the Sylphin paths, doesn't know what's happening back in the Commonwealth with the building of the second chance, you know, rocket spaceship, wormhole technology spaceship. He evolves as a person mm-hmm. on this trip. It's one of the subplots, but like Lou said, he didn't want to say too much because it turns out to be kind of an important one.
The Sylphin kind of like reminded me of, we read Last Light of the Sun, and that ancient idea of that Celtic idea of what an elf is, the mm-hmm. where it originally came from, not Lord of the Rings elves, you know, the genuine fairy tales, the kind of people that would come and steal your kids, you know, mm-hmm. And walking the paths between worlds. And that's kind of where, like, the Siddha, and I don't know how to pronounce it, but from the Dresden Files, that kind of like sinister elf that we don't really have anything in common with. It's humanoid, but it's not human. And that's what I liked. That's what I thought kind of what the Sylphin were, or my interpretation.
They hold no malice, though, at least true. In the first book, you know. They literally are true. Childlike, and they love to laugh. They're more like Lord of the Rings.
Hobbits.
The Hobbits.
Hobbits. They're more like hobbits, you know.
Well,
they just want to have a good time.
But they have rows and rows of sharp teeth.
Yeah, I got the impression that like the Sylphins that we were introduced to were kind of like the Room Springer Sylphin, and like they're the youngsters that are just getting ready to go into adulthood, and we had not seen the true
adults.
Like adults yet.
So Maureen,
am I on track at all with that?
remind me, yes. Maureen, before Lou, well, Lou blew it and answered the question.
Excellent. No, I knew it. I knew it.
You knew it. So did Ozzy start to figure that out in the first book? They're also smushing together for me.
I don't.
Josh,
remember.
What do you think about the Sylphin?
Well, the Sylphin are a little confusing because I guess the closest thing we've ever come across to them are elves and Sylphin, Sylvan, you know, has an elf. There's a word play there. Magic seems like magic. Yeah, not Lord of the Rings elves, like something more closer to true to their origin story elves. They, on one hand, kind of tease Ozzy the whole time with this sort of nanny nanny boo boo kind of attitude. You know, we know stuff, and the way we talk, you'll never figure out what the heck we mean, because they talk basically in like a constant rap riddle. And you know, he's just like following them, hoping he gets something, because he gets lost in this ice palace forever. And then he finds out that the Sylvan do hunting for pleasure, which is not something a Lord of the Rings elf could ever dream of doing. You know, so
they slaughter
these huge beast ice worm creatures that's one of my favorite scenes of the book. Is it's just so action packed and amazing,
beautifully bloodthirsty.
Yeah. They kill these and some of them die trying to battle these earthworms just for sport. So they have this side of them that's carnal, really carnal. And so I don't quite know what to make of them, except that they're fascinating and they're new. They're something different.
What about the other race that we get to know a little bit, the Rael?
They didn't pique my interest as much. They don't take as much time in the book. They're there. I'm not sure what their role is going to be go forward.
Is that the race that was on with the High Angel?
Yes, that Paula goes to. They eat data, basically.
Yeah. It was hard to find a purpose to them. And I'm sure that there is one, because Peter Hamilton doesn't seem like the kind of author that's going to throw something in willy-nilly. Like, it seemed from the first chapter that he is a very structured writer, where everything is going to have a purpose. So the Rael, they're hiding. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like he's purposefully hidden this race of creatures in there. And if anything, when an author does that, it's because they are waiting to surprise you. So based on my reading experience.
So in the first book, Polomio uses the Rael to basically like almost like from a forensic point of view. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. And they're on the High Angel and they make themselves available to her.
She goes to like the little drug rail that ends up with all of the emotions, right?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I have one line I wanted to read. This was spoken by the Rael. How you humans survive so much experience is something I shall never understand. To do so much and react to it all in the way you do is as much a curse as a blessing. You never take the time to digest and appreciate what happens to you. So the Rael experience everything at this super intense level that we don't reach, you know, and I think they're interesting, but they're also arm's length, just like the SI is arm's length, and the Sylphin. So that's kind of interesting. Humans aren't running into very many bad guys.
Right. No. And I also found that very suspicious. It's like they were targeted at planets that did not have populations in them, or that they were targeted at planets that they were only going to meet certain species.
Interesting.
I'm a big believer in the Sky Flyer guy.
Okay, let's talk about the Star Flyer.
Star Flyer.
Yes. So Josh and Maureen, tell us about the Star Flyer.
There was a ship called the Marie Celeste that crashed on the planet Far Away, which is the most farthest planet from Earth that has any humans on it, and that has wormhole technology. It only got wormhole technology till recently.
Not connected to the Unisphere.
It's not connected to the Unisphere. Okay, good. So this ship crashed there, and Johansson, and his fellow terrorists believe that this ship carried some kind of agent called the Star Flyer, who is controlling and manipulating humankind to do something bad. And Johansson now believes that the Star Flyer's mission was to get the humans to go to the Dyson Pair, to cause the shield around them to open, and then releasing Morning Light Mountain to come. So it's like a conspiracy theory. That's how the author has presented it pretty much in most of the characters, except for Bradley and his followers. As the story progresses, Polomio, the greatest detective on the humankind has ever known,
starts to believe.
Yeah, she's one of the favorite characters, starts to believe that the Starflyer could actually be real. It's like all these things are happening, and she's putting it together in her Sherlock Holmes brain that the only kind of the only logical conclusion for all of this is that there is indeed a Starflyer in the background manipulating everything, and yet she's made her career trying to catch Bradley Johansson and his terrorist. So she's in a real conundrum. And so the question is the Starflyer real or not? I have to go with yes.
Maureen, tell us about the Starflyer.
So the Starflyer, this is kind of what I think. And I'm so curious about how off base I am. The primes that left and went to the other planet, you know, built the two Dyson spheres for containment purposes. Then
hold on. So the primes built the Dyson spheres?
The primes on not Morning Light Mountains, the other primes, the Rogue Prime, Prime Rogue.
Okay, the Beta, okay? Beta Primes.
Beta Primes. They built the two Dyson spheres for containment because they could not figure out how to defeat the Alpha Primes. So they needed to pause and wait. And I'm imagining that they have some kind of eyes on the universe. And when Ozzy and Nigel stepped out onto Mars, they saw that somehow. So they sent the Marie Celeste. They have been slowly encouraging. They are the Starflyer. They have been slowly encouraging human colonization across the universe, across the galaxy, to the point where that they become, the humans can actually become a threat to the Alpha Primes, because the Beta Primes know that they can't take them out. The Beta Primes bring the humans in to tackle the Alpha Primes.
So in your theory, is the Starflyer also building the humans up to make them more powerful so they could actually take on a beast as badass as Morning Light Mountain?
Yes, the Starflyer has been encouraging human development, if that makes sense, because the technological advances, being able to regenerate, carry a brain, birth the SI, these are not things that come from wormhole technology. So
force fields. Another one, force fields.
Force fields. At least in my limited understanding of wormholes. but that would be my theory, is that human development has been manipulated for a very since we got onto Mars, and humans have been guided along a path to be able to take on this fight in place of the Beta Primes.
Okay. You said you want to know whether you are accurate. Do you want to know?
I want to read the book.
Okay.
But I also kind of want to know, Josh, do you mind going muting, like not listening for a second, so I can hear if I am anywhere near accurate?
No, we're not going to do it.
God damn it.
we're not going to ruin it.
Don't come to my party. Come on.
I do think your thought process is very, you're definitely pro Guardians of Selfhood and pro Johansson and Elvin. Maybe you don't approve of their techniques.
I'm not about bombing people and like wiping out grain just so that like, yeah, that's not cool.
What if it saved humankind? What if you took all the paths you were supposed to take and you went to the government of the Commonwealth and you went to the press and you started, you know, your own blog and nobody cared?
So my D&D alignment is true neutral. So I suppose that, and I came up with my answer and then I was like, oh yes, that is a true neutral answer. So if I would try to do it with the least amount of death possible, you know, but
it sounds just like the Selfin or the like Elvin, his big regret. So to fill in the listener,
Adam Elvin, yeah.
Adam Elvin, the person Johansson believes in, the Starflyer. He has wooed the Guardians of Selfhood, which are portrayed as kind of innocents, non-technologically advanced. They're the indigenes from far away, right? The early settlers on far away. And they're all Scottish. They wear kilts and stuff. He has recruited a former, maybe, or current idealist slash communist terrorist who is a specialist in wrecking havoc, right, and fighting the system. And that's Adam Elvin. Adam Elvin's big sin is the bombing of the train at, I think, Audubon, where he kills innocent people, and he never really feels good about it. Is he – I'm going to go through some characters and just say good guy, bad guy, okay?
Yep.
Go for
it. Is Johansson a good guy or a bad guy?
Oh, Jack, why you got to start with that
That's
one?
That's the hardest one. That's the hardest
one. An easier one.
Yeah.
If he's good, so are so many other people.
Okay, Adam.
He's a good guy.
Good guy. Mass murderer. Yeah.
Okay. Mass murderer.
Yeah. All right, Josh?
I Adam's bad. He's a mass murderer.
Okay. Nigel.
Bad guy. I don't trust money.
Nigel, I don't get. Yeah, he seems disinterested. I don't know. I feel like he's running his own agenda.
Okay. Ozzy?
Good guy.
Good guy.
Ozzy, good guy.
Okay. Guardians of selfhood in general.
Oh, man. Well, so this is the problem with that. And then Bradley Johansson is like, or Johansson is, do I believe their conspiracy? Because I know they are committed to their conspiracy. So in their story, they are good guys. If I don't believe in the Starflyer, they are bad guys. If I do believe in the Starflyer, they're misunderstood good guys. So I have to say that they're good guys.
Josh?
You know, if you judge them by their intentions, they're good guys. If you judge them by their actions, they're bad guys.
Okay, Dudley Bose.
Bad guy.
Goofball.
Definitely the toughest hang in this universe.
Definitely.
Wait till you guys hear my pick for casting person. For him.
I'm looking forward to it. I want to ask you about Gore. He is the leader of one of the Monopoly houses, so it's okay that you can't remember him.
Is he the gold guy?
Yeah, he's the gold guy.
Okay. And your question is he a good guy or
good
a bad guy?
Good guy or a bad guy?
Ooh.
I just think all those families are just out for themselves to collect power,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't make them good.
There was something that he did at the end, though, where it was a very unselfish act. And I was like, oh, this guy is not just – he enjoys money and he enjoys power, but he also is not going to hang on to it at the cost of the human race. And I don't remember what it was that he did.
Okay. Justine Bernelli.
Hard eye roll on her.
Okay.
Sorry. The whole Casimir, you're dead. I'm one of the most powerful women in the entire fucking galaxy, but now you're gone.
But don't you think she's lived 800 years without meaning? And now she has the first, you know, and just miles of asphalt in all directions. There's just a couple flowers that have broken through.
Okay.
And it's her love for Casimir.
I'm with ya, but here's the thing.
I'm with ya, but I'm not.
I'm with ya, but I don't believe that love is the only meaning that people can have. Like, I mean, if she's got no other passion than for a dick, like, I'm not on her side. You know,
okay.
800 years and the only thing that lights her up is a dick, I'm not on her side.
Okay. I feel like Justine would not like that characterization, but okay. Mark Vernon. He's on the planet that had that beautiful planet where people would go for vacations and stuff. He was an engineer. He left.
It's the planet that got bombed. He was originally on the planet where everybody was bureaucrat. And then he and his wife and their kids picked up and moved to the fun planet.
Yeah. The snowboarding planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they barely escape in a valley through a wormhole created by the SI that goes to Ozzy's pad.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a heck of a battle scene.
Oh, that was
a
awesome.
Great battle scene.
Yes.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Mark Vernon, good guy, bad guy? That's an obvious good guy, right?
Yeah, he's an everyman.
He's
yeah,
an everyman.
He's an everyman. Right. He's kind of okay. Like a meh.
And then how about Melanie? Good guy? Bad.
Amazing. Love her.
You love Melanie?
Love
Josh,
her.
Do you like Melanie?
Well, I didn't know what to think of her until the SI kind of like destroyed Motiles through her, basically, and saved everybody. Up until that point, she was kind of a tragic character, mm-hmm. and it seems like she had done some things that were kind of selfish, you know, and I was kind of like, I'm not sure about this one.
I'm not feeling her. Okay.
But then she kind of comes through there in the end. And I don't know how much of that is her, and I don't know how much of that is the
SI
taking over her.
She to me is like the opposite of Justine, where she starts off as like a selfish and self-centered, very naive young woman, right? Mm-hmm. And she gets used hardcore and tossed aside and is heartbroken. And then, you know, she's in this vulnerable situation and people are continuing to try to take advantage of her. And she just says no. And like, starts to kind of build her own life and starts to use like she really starts to build her own kind of empire. And I mean, she's a smart, smart cookie. She's very driven. I mean, she's the one that figures it out in the end. She's the one that figures out that there is a Starflyer and who the Starflyer is communicating with on the planet. You know, it's mm-hmm. her, you know, and like, I love her. She uses her assets to get what she wants. I love her. I would love to party with her.
Okay, so you're going to go good hang. On
good
Melanie.
Hang. Great hang. We would have a great time.
Who's the best hang in the saga? Is it Ozzy?
Lou, who's the best hang?
Ozzy. Mm-hmm. Ozzy's the best hang. He's not just incredibly smart, but he's just a free spirit, you know. So you can get in trouble with him. You can go, you know, you can just hang with him. You can eat with him. He likes to eat, you know, and he's just a chill guy. I mean, he's an easy, he sounds like the easiest hang out of everybody.
He's fun. He's like, let's go on the Sylvan Paths. Why not?
Why not?
Let's go for it.
Let's go search.
For me, Ozzy's a good hang if I have a chip that can download me when I die, because whatever he's going to get me into is probably going to kill me. But,
he's not afraid to die at all.
Mm. He's not. I feel like he has, like, back in his meteor pad where he, like, lives on, like, an asteroid or something that he, like, bought and designed or something. And I feel like he's got, like, 10 clones ready to go, you know? Like, as soon as he dies, download up.
I have one criticism of the book. One, and it has to do with Ozzy's pad, because if I read it correctly, and I may not have read it correctly, but it sounded like he had hollowed out an asteroid and built this beautiful, like, thing in it. But the thing is there are waterfalls everywhere, and it's an echo chamber, and waterfalls are really freaking loud. So it felt like the one thing that if Peter Hamilton if there was one thing that Peter Hamilton overlooked, and it is the tiniest damn thing, but is that if you have waterfalls all over the place in an echo chamber, you're going to go insane.
my entire suspension of disbelief.
Oh no.
Right. The author did not address.
Didn't do it. You know, wormhole technology didn't do it. It's the freaking waterfalls.
It's so fake that he didn't, because I knew it was fake because he didn't deal with all the ambient noise that waterfalls did not.
Precisely.
How are we going to do that in the movie? How are we going to deal with that in the movie?
But my best hang, hot take, Paula. Like, I just want to trail after Sherlock Holmes for a year, you know?
She's not
that would be cool as hell.
She doesn't have much personality.
I don't care. She's the smartest woman in the universe.
That is true.
She's smart. She's driven. She's determined. I just want to follow behind her and carry whatever it is she needs me to carry.
Lou, who is your worst hang?
My worst hang would be...
Human. Human.
Human. Nigel would be my worst hang.
Me too. Nigel would be my worst
hang. He's just
unbearable.
Yeah, he's so full of himself.
Dudley both.
And Dudley. Oh, hold on.
Dudley is the worst hang.
Dudley Bose, okay. The most annoying person in the universe. You know, he really wrote the most annoying person who gets under your from the very beginning. You know,
how about you, Josh?
My worst hang is probably, I think Adam Elvin would be a downer for me. He just seems so down. Oh. And all of his jobs are like serious and heavy. He doesn't get to do any of the fun stuff, just serious. And he's got this conscious, the past and all that kind of stuff. He seems kind of lost. I don't know. I think he'd be just a drag to be around. Nigel, I might be able to like tune him out. Dudley Bose, you know, maybe I could get him on some tangents about, you know, astronomy or astrology. But Adam, I just think would be a downer.
Mm-hmm. He'd be very negative force.
Well, let's think about who we are going to cast in Hollywood. But before we do Hollywood, it's time for us to take a break and have a word from the sponsor of this episode of Books from Earth.
Today's podcast is made possible by Authoritarian Magazine. Are you an aspiring autocrat, a mad genius, or an evil mastermind? If so, you need Authoritarian Magazine. Immerse yourself in the world of authoritarianism, deception and repression, bureaucratic labyrinth and military coup d'etat. Choose the ideal subscription offer and get the magazine delivered directly to your doorstep. Free home delivery, and you can cancel anytime, but you won't want to cancel it. And here's why. The writers here are some of the best writers. Some of them have had a profound influence on my life. Let me get to it. Who wrote articles in this month? Sauron. He wrote an article about the elegance of brute force. Darth Sidious extols the virtues of deception. And Lord Voldemort, he penned a great article about post-totalitarian author. Wow, he must be super smart. I can't even read the words he wrote. Whatever that is, I don't even know. Even our new friend, Morning Light Mountain, contributed to this month's magazine with an article about interstellar genocide. Seems like something he would know about. All very informative stuff if you have designs on taking over the world. Authoritarian Magazine, I'm telling you, if you're a Dr. Evil type, this is going to be the perfect reading material for you. Just leave it on the back here of your toilet. You don't even need to bring your iPhone in with you, because you're just going to be riveted by these great articles. Right now, they're running a special exclusive to Books from Earth listeners. If you go to their website, which is just http://authoritarianmagazine, all one word, no spaces, .com/books from earth. That's our code, Books from Earth. You enter that and you get your first month's magazine free. So you're only paying for 11 months, but you get 12 months worth of just amazing content. Some of the other great authors, Darth Vader, I mentioned Dr. Evil. He's got a running monthly column, answers questions. Dr. Doom, he's short and to the point, very terse writing style, but very good. Lex Luthor answers fan mail. He's also on the editorial board. This is just stuff if you want to take over the world or the solar system or the galaxy or whatever it is that interests you as an aspiring authoritarian, this is perfect for you. So go to, I'll say it one more time, www.authoritarianmagazine.com/books from earth. That's our code. Enter it at checkout, 1 month free. With that, back to the pod.
Okay, well, hey, welcome to Hollywood. We have an unlimited budget. And we get to make all the decisions. So we're going to think about what we want to do with Peter Hamilton's Pandora's Star and, you know, Judas Unchained, the next book. And we're going to do some casting. We're going to think about movie TV. And I've got some other questions that I think we need to iron out before we produce this amazing, amazing show or movie. And, you know, we're going to do some casting. And I want to do Wilson Keim first. And Lou, I think your favorite passage is a scene that is, you know, seminal to Wilson Keim's life, professional and personal. So let's let that be an introduction to him, and we will get into casting.
Yeah, so my favorite scene was the prologue is the beginning where Wilson Keim is lands on Mars, and he thinks that it's supposed to be this, you know, first of its kind, you know, history making event for mankind. And then Ozzy and Nigel, I think it's Nigel, mess everything up, you know. So it's just really, really funny. And it starts with Commander Lewis with his, he says, "I take this step for all humanity so that we may walk together as one people along the road to the stars." Wilson winced at the words. Lewis sounded incredibly sincere. Then someone sniggered. Actually sniggered out loud. He could hear quite plainly over the general communications band. Mission control would go ballistic over that. Then he forgot it all as Lewis took his first step onto the surface, his foot sinking slightly into the red sands of Mars to make firm imprint. You know, I just thought that this is supposed to be like this, you know, breathtaking moment. And then somebody laughs in the background, you know, just sniggers, you know, it's like, you know, I just thought it was.
And it just occurred to me, it was the sniggering from Ozzy.
I think it was on the moon.
Nigel was on the moon, and Ozzy was in the background, laughing. You know, because you know they were watching the whole thing, like, "Ha ha, we beat you." You know,
who should we cast for Wilson Keim?
Well, I had one. Edward James Olmos. That was my first thought. Wilson Keim.
Well, he's the iconic. He's the iconic, you know, captain of the Starfleet, you know, Battlestar Galactica solidified him on that. So we got to get him in for casting. Who else? Anybody else got somebody for Wilson?
John Hamm.
Okay. That would be an interesting stretch for him. Let's call him in. So I've been watching The Expanse, and I'm kind of wanting to see if Stephen Strait, you know, the guy who is the captain of the Rocinante could give it a whirl. Might be a stretch for him. I don't know if he can be a heavyweight.
Yeah, this character does need to be a heavyweight.
He also needs to be young, right? Because everybody's relatively young.
Yeah, John Hamm's not young, but he's got the Superman, Christopher Reeves look.
Ooh, Henry Cavill would also be good.
What's he in?
He's Superman. He was just in The Witcher. Like, I loved one until I was
he would
like,
be great.
Henry Cavill, he'll be great.
Good. I think we got some variety there. Oh, like Paula Mayo.
Paula. Yes, I've got one for her. Ming-Na Wen, who is most recently, I think, going to be in the new Book of Boba Fett. She's been in Marvel. She's been in everything. Do you guys know who I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yes. Yep, yeah, she's great. She was in
Help me out.
Mandalorian.
What else? She was in Mandalorian?
She was wasn't she Boba Fett's sidekick?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. She was
Boba Fett. It is Boba Fett.
That was Boba Fett.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paula Mayo is supposedly half Filipino. So, you know, at least if we're going to try to remain true to some sort of ancestry, that works. And I don't have anybody really better. I thought of someone. I just had to go and look at people, but no one came to mind. Anybody else?
I had Grace Park. She was in Battlestar Galactica.
Oh yeah, she's great.
Oh yeah.
Ozzy.
I've got a good one for Ozzy.
All right.
You guys ready? You sitting down?
Yeah. Blow us away, Jack.
Keegan Michael Kay.
Oh, I love him.
He is Key and Peele. He is Brain Games, which I have an 8-year-old, so I do watch Brain Games a lot on National Geographic. But he's Key and Peele. I think he's done Saturday Night Live, Mad TV, Whose Line Is It Anyway? He had a recurring role on Parks and Recreation. He's done it like so many Disney-type movies.
We'll have to get him in. I think Idris would be a good Ozzy.
Idris Elba?
Yeah.
Idris Elba?
Too much of a badass.
I love them both.
Okay, alternatively, I have Donald Glover. Like, if we want to take Ozzy and like a funny kind of humorous route.
I had Michael Renna, because he's kind of a comedian, you know, Ozzy. And he was also kind of serious, you know. And I don't know if you guys know who that is. He was a really funny guy in Ant-Man and Wasp.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
I love that guy.
You know, he was the one who was driving the vehicle around, you know.
That's good.
Yeah.
He's great.
You know, I thought he'd make a perfect Ozzy. You'd give him the afro, you know.
Yeah. So my pick is Justin Cornwell, who was kind of got his big break in Jingle Jangle on Netflix. He's an outstanding actor. And the reason I think that he might be the best choice is because he's only in his early 30s. But he's got the heavy hitter Shakespearean actor, can do the comedy, can do the enthusiasm. His line delivery is freaking fantastic. This guy is such a good actor. And really, I just want to see him in everything. So I put him in this because he's going to be my number one pick for a long time.
You're acting like Justine Brunelli towards him.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Aw. Wow. Ouch.
Wow.
Ouch.
But I'm seeing his picture, and as a straight married man, I can even kind of get where you're coming from.
Well, look him up in Jingle Jangle. It was an interesting but beautiful costume choice.
Bradley Johansson. Anybody got a casting?
I do. Matthew McConaughey.
Oh yeah.
Ooh. Oh man, that's great.
I know, right?
That's great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
That's a good choice for that one, right?
Let's just put all our eggs in that basket.
That's a good call.
The perfect amount of schmarmy but charming and like, yeah. Oh, he's good. Yeah.
He could be wild eyed.
Yeah. Yeah. Cult leader. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dudley Bowes.
I got one. I got two.
I didn't have anyone.
I got one, but I need a time machine to make mine perfect. Mm. Go ahead, Maureen.
Okay. So old Dudley Bowes, Ricky Gervais, and I know that he mostly does comedy. But the bumbling for non-comedic effect and the frustration and basically the incredible condescension that Ricky Gervais comes with,
yes,
would be perfect.
God, he would be unbearable.
Yeah, for old Dudley Bowes.
He would be unbearable.
Young Dudley Bowes would be Owen Teague, who was just in CBS's The Stand. And he played Harold Lauder, and he was the most evil son of a bitch, the kind of guy that you can picture going into a school and shooting everyone in the cafeteria. And that is how I see young Dudley Bowes.
Yeah, he's pretty good too. That's a really good one.
That is a good pick.
All right. Mine, we're going to have to crank up the time machine, and we get a young Rick Moranis.
Ooh, that's a good pick.
Wow.
And you have to use the time machine, which is always a bonus.
Yeah. Wow. That I went in kind of a totally different direction than both of you guys. I was thinking Mark Rylance, because he can do that sort of absent-minded professor kind of thing. And he would have to be a little less serious perhaps for this role. But that's going to be a casting slugfest.
Definitely. Dude, I love it. We got a good production on our hands.
I think Mike Rylance is too likable.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If he can go, but he's got the whole bumbling professor thing. If he can do a little bit of a darker side, you know, maybe may not work. I think we should give him a chance to stretch.
Sure, sure. I don't want to hold anyone's career back.
How about Adam Elvin?
We're going to have to crank up the time machine again. Charles Bronson, a young Charles Bronson.
If we could do the time machine, I think he'd be perfect.
Yeah. Same hair, same complexion, same build. Feel good about that one.
Yeah.
You know, I keep thinking about Mission Impossible when I think of Adam Elvin, because all of his best scenes are him, you know, getting instructions on doing something impossible and then him trying to carry out something impossible. And I keep thinking, if we could get Tom Cruise to become a little depressed and not be the lead.
Tom Cruise is a Wilson Keim, though, too.
Did you see Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder?
Yeah, he can do anything he wants.
Yeah.
That's amazing in Tropic Thunder.
I can actually see Tom Cruise doing a really good Adam Alvin with the amount of anger that he is able to portray. But the problem is he's so funny when he does that. I don't want him in that part because I like to keep – like, he would be terrifying, I think.
He'd be a very scary – and he would also dominate every scene he's in, and I don't know if that's Adam's personality either.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Well, Matthew McConaughey and Tom Cruise. Who's going to dominate?
Ooh.
Hmm?
Ooh.
Matthew
McConaughey. You're right. You're right. That would be – that's a heavyweight.
Yeah.
If we don't get Matthew, we probably got to ditch Tom. So we got to
– And Tom Cruise and Ming-Na Wen, like, that – like, they would be perfect. Her badassery and Tom Cruise's anger. I like this.
Okay. All right. Melanie. Well,
guys, we got to keep that time machine cranking.
Who you got?
I've got 13 going on 30. Jennifer Garner.
All right. She's a badass.
Yeah, she's a badass. She's athletic, beautiful, right? But it's not today's Jennifer Garner, who's also badass, beautiful. It's the 13 going on 30.
Mm-hmm.
Openings. Okay, movie or TV?
It can't be a movie. It's got to be streaming.
It's the next Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's got to have a lot of TNA.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah.
Eight to 12 episodes.
8 to 12. Okay. I was gonna go multiple seasons with 8 to 12 episodes.
Multiple seasons, I thought too.
Yeah.
I mean, minimum 8 to 12, but we just wanted to tell the story like kind of like lockstep chronological. If we want to indulge in it, get people.
And I don't think we'd want to make it too sci-fi like. We want it to be.
Should the opening scene be the prologue?
Yes.
That Lou read from? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, there's no doubt. Okay.
This is one
you meet three of like the six or seven main characters and you learn so much about them.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm wondering, this is one where I would totally open it in medias res, where we would I would open it with the battle from the primes nuking the planet. Start it there and then build it back to how did we get here? You know, that in starting a series that way. And then each season, you kind of find out a little bit more and then a little bit more. That's what I would do.
That's pretty good.
Obviously, the prologue can't be skipped. It's essential.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, like, there's so much world building.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if our, you know, the watchers are going to have the patience to do so many episodes that we need to do the world building. To wait for the sort of to get introduced to Morning Light Mountain,
right?
Or something, you know. I mean, maybe it could be the scene with the battle. Maybe it could just be like this visual of Morning Light Mountain. Maybe it could be when Dudley Bowes and his shipmate get left behind. You mm-hmm. know, somewhere around there, like. Oh, there's something really big that this is leading to. Okay, yeah, let's rewind and maybe spoon feed in little bits in here and there in episodes what that's about. I don't know. Just in case, because the world of it – it took me a while. I mean, I really had to hang in there with this book to get to where I was
you
like –
You won't have to hang in with the second one, dude. It is a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Well, the second one's just a continuation of the first. I mean, but to get our viewers through.
Right. But – the thing is, Josh, you do make a good point. And like part of being able to do the through plot lines, if you wanted to include the scene with the prologue, it would be very easy to do that as like Nigel is discussing going to go like recruit Wilson. And then you can kind of see the like the tension there, and then you have like a little flashback scene where it's like, oh hey, you know, beat you here, you know.
Yeah, you could do that. I think each character would have to have its own music, almost, write their own like background music to so that you could, because there's so many characters, and I also think it would be a mistake to do a ton of different hairstyles. Like, you'd want to keep these people looking the same.
Same the whole time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, this would be maybe a good one, and I say this in half jest for maybe the CW channel to do, because in all those shows, everybody's young and good looking.
That's a fact. They are. They are. Yes. But I don't. I disagree, though.
Rating. The rating can't be CW.
Can we get whoever did The Expanse to do it? They get the reins of this show?
They're good.
Okay, so in the TV show, what do the Silphin look like? Do they look like more like fairies, more like elves, or Lord of the Ring elves? Do they look
totally
foreign?
I think they're
7
feet tall. They look like elves 7 feet tall with razor-sharp teeth.
Okay.
Are they minimalist elves, or are they like, you know, really
big? No, these are elves? Keebler elves. Keebler elves.
You're more like Keebler. Yeah.
Without the hat. Yeah, without the hat.
I kind of pictured them as like Avatar people.
Next question.
Next question is, how about
Morning
the Prime?
Light Mountain. Prime. Yeah, he's not going to be great on the screen. He's Jabba the Hutt without movement.
I thought he was kind of like a pear with four arms.
Yeah, and like congestion when he breathes.
Yeah. You're going to be real gross.
Does Prime even breathe?
I don't know.
They were covered in mucus, right?
Covered in mucus. He does feed.
Speaking of music, Prime has got to have some great music.
Yeah.
I'm thinking almost like some industrial metal music, you know, because he's so industrial, you know? He's just mostly machine, hardly any actual organic material.
He just constantly enters to Matrix soundtrack.
Scandinavian death metal.
Yes.
Yeah. And like, love it. And like when he's on the screen, it's like got that shimmering stuff that goes on, you know, so it's not really clear because the massive amount of whatever electrostatic stuff he puts off, no camera could actually get a clear, quite nice, clear lens on him.
I like it.
Or whatever it is. Okay. All right. That's just my vision. That's just my vision. We're going deep on that one. But, all right, rapid fire round. Ready? Everybody ready?
Lusu, unmute. Lusu, unmute. Okay.
Lusu, you ready? Rapid fire.
I'm going to try.
Okay.
Losers try.
there is no try. There's only do. So, Lou, you're first. Would you rather be Silphin or human?
Silphin. In this book?
Sorry?
Silphin.
Jack, Silphin or human?
Human.
Maureen?
Human.
Ouch. I just want to try to be Silphin too, Lou. So you and me, buddy. We're doing the paths.
We're together.
I want to walk the Silphin paths, but I don't want to be a Silphin.
But you don't even know what it's like, man. See? Lou does.
Are you sure?
Ask Lou. And now I'm not sure, but you know, it's my only chance to be Silphin.
It's the only chance. Plus, I don't want to live forever.
Oh, good point. I guess the Silphin died.
I guess that. Yeah, I didn't know that. Thanks, Lou.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. Do you stay in the Ice Palace, or do you try to get free by following the Silphin?
Try to get free.
Yeah. Everybody tries to get free. Yeah. The Ice Palace. I do not like the cold. We can all rejuvenate. Jack, do you rejuvenate like to always stay within your prime, whatever that is? You know, or do you kind of let yourself get older and experience aging and then rejuve?
I get older, but I stay in shape.
Okay. All right. Okay. Maureen?
I get older.
Okay. Lou?
Stay in my prime.
Yeah, man. I'm with you and me and you, buddy.
If I had a chance, I'll stay in my prime.
I don't have a back that aches and whatever. What planet do you want to live on and why? Go, Maureen.
Far away, it seems like a really big adventure and a lot of fun stuff to do and exploring.
Jack.
The planet that got attacked by the primes, but not when it got attacked. But you know, that had the one big enzyme bonded concrete road and the kind of cultish guy who founded it, but actually seems like kind of a good dude also. Whatever the name of that planet is.
All right. Lusu?
Far away from the adventure.
All right. All right. Yep. Gotcha. I'm going to Alon. That's the vacation planet that has like beautiful coral reefs and the skiing. And it's just like a place where people go to have wonderful, like the rich go for to have to play.
That's I will I come visit you on Alon.
Alon is where they attacked, right?
No, I think it's a different planet.
Oh.
Okay. But it had a similar thing, I think.
Okay.
Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Mine's, mine's like 90% nature preserve.
Yeah. Yes.
Like no nukes.
Right. They didn't want the thing on to be put on it.
That's right.
What makes this book special? Jack, what makes this book special?
Two things. World building and Morning Light Mountain.
Maureen?
It is extremely well plotted.
Mm-hmm. Lusu, what makes this book special?
World building, like Jack said. And for me, it read like a mystery also.
Oh, yeah.
Love mysteries.
I'm struggling with what makes this book special because it was just so kind of like mind-blowing in so many ways. I'm going to have to go with what one thing that it introduced was this theme of immortality. They just took care of the idea of death and like, you know, really up the stakes because now people get to live forever. And that I thought that was something that made the book special.
Except for the 23 worlds.
Those people are completely wiped out.
Well, you got to go back into that nuclear holocaust to try to find all those crystals buried under the ash and the ice. Right. I mean, I'm guessing.
Unless they'd uploaded
to the Unisphere.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good call.
But if they hadn't, they could be lost. Like you said earlier, days, months, weeks, years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And with that, I think I'll read in my favorite passage, which is pretty short. Poor woman, Liz said. Yeah. She needs to go into rejuve. I wonder if CST will pay for that. Why does she need rejuve? Mark peered at her image inside the portal. She doesn't look like she's that old. Liz took advantage of this distraction to spoon up two lots of pudding. Compared to whom? Dudley Bose's replacement clone is going to be an 18-year-old. She'll have a physical equivalence of late 50s. Trust me, that's not a marriage you want to try. Well, I suppose not. I just can't stop thinking about Bose and for Becky. Talk about being abandoned a long way from home. Do you think they suicided when they realized? Depends on the Dyson aliens. Maybe they built them an environment chamber. And right now, they've cracked the translation hurdle and they're chatting away happily. You don't really believe that, do you? Liz chewed thoughtfully for a moment. Professor Trutton was helping Wendy Bose back into her house. Nope, their body dead. I figured that too. His gaze wandered up to the cheap composite ceiling. You know, Alon's almost the closest Commonwealth planet to the Dyson pair. There are seven closer than us, including Anshin. But you're right, we're close, she giggled. Only 754 light years away. Scary, huh? He reached around with his free hand and poked her just below the ribs, where he knew she was sensitive. Ow! Liz screwed up her face and retaliated by scooping up a giant piece of pudding. Hey! He protested. I've barely had a mouthful yet. Well, life's a bitch. Then you rejuvenate and do it all over again. This Books from Earth podcast featuring Pandora Star by Peter Hamilton. We'd like to remind you to check out Authoritarian Magazine. You can find more information about Authoritarian Magazine at www.authoritarianmagazine, all one word, no punctuation, .com/Books from Earth for a discount. Remember, we don't endorse the views in the magazine. We just believe everyone needs a chance. At booksfromearth.com, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe, rate us, or visit our website, booksfromearth.com. Earth makes great books. Come relive them with us. So long, and until next time on the Sylphin Paths, this is Josh, Marie, and Jack, and Lou signing off.
Bye, Ada. Everybody.
Good night.
He would be a great Tarl. He's been in some movies.
Yeah, he's done. He's not afraid of the big screen.
Yep. Kevin Costner's movie about the flooded planet.
Waterworld.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Movie or TV show?
Flooded planet. Up with Waterworld. Sorry.
Right? Is that Waterworld? Waterworld, right?
Waterworld.
Yeah. What a great original title.
What about, you know, the one about the flooded planet?
I didn't see the movie. I think I watched it on double speed or something. It was a tough watch for me. I like apocalyptic stuff, right? That's our podcast has that. But just he had the gills. He had the gills. I just couldn't, you know, what happened to Tonka? That was so original, but the gills were just too much. Couldn't get past it. Mad Max with water instead of sand.
Yeah. It's like when Doctor Who fooled me with Melody, Pond, and River Song. And that's a deep cut right there. Okay.
Yeah, that's... The seven people listen to this pod, I doubt if it's a single one of them.
Oh my god.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll get it together.
Waterworld. It's like an amusement park.
Okay.
It is, actually. It's an amusement park.
Is it really?
Yeah.
We should go there.
We should go there. It's in Denver. Figures are landlocked. Oh god.
I've had so much caffeine.
Yeah. It was the most expensive film ever made at the time it was made.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And it bombed.
It bombed.
I saw it in the theaters.
I've never been able to finish it.
It's Kevin Costner, so I didn't go see it.
It got $88 million, a total of $264 million, which in today's number seems like a total failure. Okay, sorry, we totally digressed and smashed Waterworld. Apologies to Waterworld fans.